Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
On Valentine's Day 2004, one of Italy's greatest cyclists was found dead in mysterious circumstances.
There's growing mystery about the death of one of the country's sporting heroes, Marco Pantani.
In November 2021, new evidence had come to light, alleging that the Italian mafia were involved in Marco Pantani's death.
The mafia goes where money is.
It's a very dark story, the Pantani story.
Sport's strangest crimes. Marco Pantani, Death of a Pirate.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 26th of June, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Saturday's uprising by Wagner mercenaries in Russia has shown how President Putin's decision to invade Ukraine has spread chaos in his own country. Neither President Putin or the Wagner leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, have been seen since the uprising was called off. The right-wing New Democracy Party in Greece has won a second term of office with a clear majority in Parliament. Also in this podcast...
I love the man. I think he's incredible. My family basically grew up in Elton, so my parents love him. I love him.
The singer and composer Elton John gives his final UK concert at the Glastonbury Festival in front of thousands of fans. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the Wagner mercenary group's mutiny against the Kremlin underscored how President Putin's decision to invade Ukraine had sown chaos in his own country. Mr. Blinken said the rebellion on Saturday by such a close ally as Yevgeny Prigozhin exposed fresh cracks in President Putin's leadership. Mr. Blinken told the US network ABC that the challenge to the Russian leader may not yet be over.
This has been a devastating strategic failure for Putin. Across virtually every front, economic, military, geopolitical standing. We see cracks emerging. Where they go, if anywhere, when they get there, very hard to say. I don't want to speculate on it, but I don't think we've seen the final act.
Our correspondent in the US, David Willis, says Mr. Blinken chose his words carefully.
These were the first comments by an official of the Biden administration since the crisis broke out in Russia, and Antony Blinken chose those words, as I say, very carefully indeed. What stood out for me is that he clearly believes that the revolt that we've seen in Russia over the last day or so presents an opportunity for the West in the same way that it presents a challenge for Vladimir Putin.
Neither President Putin nor Yevgeny Prigozhin have appeared in public since the uprising was called off on Saturday. But the leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has said he's spoken to Mr. Putin on Sunday. There's been speculation that the Russian leader fled Moscow during the crisis after his presidential jets were tracked leaving the city. As part of the deal to end the mutiny, Mr. Prigozhin agreed to move to Belarus. He was last seen waving at supporters from the back of a car as he left the city of Rostov-on-Don on Saturday. Our World Affairs editor John Simpson now considers how much Mr. Putin's credibility has been undermined by the Wagner rebellion.
Vladimir Putin's PR machine has always made a point of his toughness. He's the man who rides horses bareback or wrestles with bears and whose enemies tend to fall out of windows or die of poison. But with Yevgeny Prigozhin's Wagner group heading up the motorway towards Moscow, Vladimir Putin didn't look quite so tough when he went on television to tell them to stop. And that's the moment a lot of people will remember, even though Prigozhin did stop, either because Putin promised him something he couldn't resist or because Putin threatened him with something he dared not ignore. But at a time when Ukraine is advancing, even if slowly, on the battlefield, and Ukrainian weapons are hitting Russian territory, this is a major blow to the Putin image. Public opinion tends to be pretty passive in Russia, but Putin will worry that someone in or close to the Kremlin will decide that he's not as tough as he's always presented himself. And he won't easily forget the way the crowds cheered Prigozhin's troops when they briefly occupied the city of Rostov-on-Don.
Let's get a view now from someone who's negotiated the Kremlin corridors of power for years. Sergei Markov is a former advisor to Vladimir Putin, a former MP for Mr. Putin's United Russia Party, and now a political analyst. James Menendez asked him to what extent the rebellion had weakened the president.
It's partly weakened Vladimir Putin because it showed to everybody that the country is going to the wrong direction. Not only Russia appeared to be in the two wars same time. It's war against Ukrainian army and it's war with global West. And additionally to this military putsch and columns of the mutineers almost come to the Moscow. It's clear for everybody that country is on the wrong direction.
Can I ask you this?
Yes.
Can you explain what happened on Saturday when President Putin came out in the morning and said that he was going to crush the traitors, but by the evening he'd done a deal with Mr. Prigozhin and the Wagner mercenaries, offering them an amnesty and then safe passage to Mr. Prigozhin?
The happen is a peaceful resolution. We expected that if real fighting happened in the Moscow region, we don't know who will be the winner. But we understand that people come to the compromise, and this compromise has been fully supported by majority of the people.
And we saw many people, for example, in Rostov cheering on the Wagner mercenaries. I mean, they are popular among many people, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It's full of paradox. Their political ideas to go with march on Moscow not supported. But same time, their criticism against state bureaucracy, their criticism against Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu is supported. And they supported personally as hero in the battle against neo-Nazi.
Do you think President Putin then is going to sack Mr. Shoigu? Do you think that's going to happen in the next few days?
I think Vladimir Putin will fire Sergei Shoigu and head of general headquarters Valery Gerasimov, but he will do it in few weeks or probably in a couple of months in order to show that he is doing himself, but not under the pressure of the mutineers.
The trouble is, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but everything ultimately does come back to President Putin. I mean, he appointed Mr. Shoigu in the first place. He effectively allowed Mr. Prigozhin to create the Wagner Group, and he made the decision to go into Ukraine. So doesn't it all this show that Mr. Putin himself has made a lot of wrong decisions, terrible decisions?
Of course. Everybody understands that it's Putin's responsibility that he didn't send Russian troops to the Ukraine 9 years ago. The fact that Russian special military operations have not been well prepared, it's also responsibility of Vladimir Putin. And the fact that one of the mostly effective part of the Russian military sends the troops to Moscow, of course, it's responsibility of Vladimir Putin. But on another hand, paradoxically, people, after these mistakes of Vladimir Putin, they support Vladimir Putin even more.
Are you sure? I just wonder whether the perception is that actually, you know, this guy is not particularly good at his job and he's made too many mistakes now.
Yeah. You're right. He's making a lot of mistakes. It's clear for everybody. But again, I should repeat, his popularity even increase because people see Putin not as the hero, but also the symbol of stability. And they believe if Putin will be replaced by somebody else, the chaos will come.
Sergei Markov with James Menendez. On the surface, the last few days have witnessed a huge falling out then between the Wagner Group leader and the Russian president. But can we be certain that falling out is real and permanent? A question I put to Vitaly Shevchenko of BBC Monitoring.
This is a question that's being asked by a lot of Russia watchers. They are wondering, is this apparent coup attempt for real? And I have to say that claiming that this is some sort of incomprehensibly complicated plot, this is probably a conspiracy theory too far. But questions remain, such as, if there was a massively long threatening convoy of Wagner hardware and men on the move to Moscow, which had apparently covered 500 miles in just one day. Where are the pictures of it? Videos. All we've seen are pictures and videos of a tank here, a truck there, but not complete convoy. Also, after Wagner was able to take Rostov-on-Don and Russia's main command centre for military operations in Ukraine, arguably one of the most protected places in Russia, and things seem to be going so well for Yevgeny Prigozhin, suddenly he does a U-turn. He says, we're going back. What happened there? We don't know. So at this moment in time, I'm afraid there are more questions than answers in this story, which is hardly surprising when you're dealing with Russia.
Looking at it from the perspective of Ukraine and the conflict in Ukraine, on the surface, any display of Russian weakness might bring some joy to President Zelensky and Ukrainian forces. On the other hand, if this leads to a change of military leadership in Russia, things in Ukraine might be about to get a lot tougher.
Well, absolutely. People in Ukraine and officials in Ukraine have been watching the latest goings-on in Russia with glee and a certain degree of expectation. However, if the point is to streamline military command in Russia and Wagner mercenaries are required or encouraged to sign official contracts with the Ministry of Defense of Russia by the 1st of July, if that happens, if military command in Russia becomes more effective, that's bad news for Ukraine. However, whatever happens next, wherever Yevgeny Prigozhin heads, one thing that is absolutely certain is that both Vladimir Putin and Yevgeny Prigozhin are wounded, weakened. Their standing in the eyes of their supporters has been severely compromised. They've promised to do things they never did. So the system of governance created by Vladimir Putin over the course of more than 20 years in charge of Russia has become more unstable, and this is not over yet for the Russian president.
Vitaly Shevchenko, BBC Monitoring. A US think tank that records military activity says Russian forces launched their largest series of missile strikes on Ukraine in many weeks on Saturday, despite what was happening in Russia. The Institute for the Study of War said Ukraine's military had reported nearly 50 cruise missiles launched from over the Caspian and Black Seas. They say most were shot down, but residential areas were hit. Meanwhile, Saturday's turmoil in Russia has raised the hopes of some Ukrainians that it could signal the beginning of the end of the 16-month conflict. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Myeni Jones, has been assessing how the mood has changed.
Ukrainians, like millions of people around the world, followed this weekend's development in Russia closely. People were glued to their TVs, and there was social media commentary on the unfolding situation late into the night. But as Kyiv's residents woke up on Sunday morning, the mood was subdued as they pondered what to make of this frankly bizarre weekend.
We were a bit disappointed when it finished so early. We expected that they would move their forces back to Russia from our lands.
For me, both Prigozhin and Putin are war criminals. They bomb peaceful cities while people are sleeping. For example, yesterday, everyone was talking about Prigozhin when Ukraine was hit by missiles. I'm not interested in him. He's a criminal.
Over the weekend, Kyiv kept pushing the message that its counteroffensive was still making slow and steady progress, despite the unfolding events in Russia. This war continues to claim Ukrainian lives on a daily basis, and with President Putin vowing to plough on with his special military operation, this weekend's events won't achieve what Ukrainians ultimately want: lasting peace.
Staying in Ukraine, a curious legacy of World War II next, the remains of 8 British Hurricane fighter planes, which had been found buried in a forest in the country. The aircraft was sent to the Soviet Union by Britain after Nazi Germany invaded in 1941. They were part of a package of military support for the USSR, paid for by the US. And similar legislation is being used by the American government now to send military aid to Ukraine as it seeks to expel Russian forces from its soil. From Kyiv, this report from our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale.
We've come to a forest in the middle of, well, nowhere. It's about 2 hours' drive south of Kyiv, and we're walking through the undergrowth, down a little ravine. It's completely overgrown. It used to be a stream a long time ago, but it's pretty dry. And there's a hole in the ground, and in the hole, a rusty structure. Lots of spars fixed together. Some of them still intact, some of them looking pretty weak, as if they're about to fall off.
So what is this?
Here you see the tailplane of Hurricane Mark II.
Yes, you heard that right. This is what's left of what was once a Hurricane fighter plane. One of 3,000 Britain gave the Soviet Union in 1941 after Nazi Germany invaded.
Sincere friendship and mutual respect mark the collaboration between British and Russian flyers operating over Soviet soil.
The Hurricane was the workhorse of the Battle of Britain, shooting down more enemy aircraft than a Spitfire. And according to Alex Stan, an aviation investigator helping with the dig, they were exactly what the Soviets needed.
Hurricane was a strong, easy-to-fly machine, stable as a gun platform, suitable for not experienced pilots, and a reliable aircraft.
So this is a small piece of history. This is physical evidence of a moment 80 years ago when Western powers were giving warplanes to people in Ukraine, as they are now, to defend this country against an invading army. They reckon there are now 8 Hurricanes buried here. Because what happened was that these aircraft were often chopped up, shoved over the edge, sometimes by tractors, sometimes by bulldozers. All the spare parts were taken out first, all the metal that could potentially be used for other things. And then they were unceremoniously dumped in this ditch and then covered over and left to rot until now.
But why? Why did the Soviets destroy perfectly good planes? That's because these Hurricanes might have been made in Britain, but they were paid for by the United States. And after the war, the Soviets did not want to pay the US back for any aircraft left intact, as was required by the Lend-Lease Agreement.
All of this has to be taken out by hand. And we're going to help the team see if we can take this particular tail fin out. We're just carrying this tailplane out of the ravine here. And you know what? It's a heavy piece of kit.
Okay. Why not?
We've come to Ukraine's National Aviation Museum, and it's an extraordinary place, a graveyard of ancient Soviet aircraft that just littered across the ground. And we're just outside a hangar where we've just taken the frame of the Hurricane that we've discovered out of the ground, and it's now been cleaned with a high-pressure hose. The mud of 8 decades coming off it pretty easily.
Valery Romanenko, head of research at Ukraine's National Aviation Museum, told us these Hurricanes are symbols of past British assistance that echo today.
In 1941, the Britain was the first who supplied fighting aircraft for the Soviet Union in mass scale, numerous aircraft. Now, the Great Britain is the first country which gives Storm Shadow cruise missiles to our armed forces.
Is history repeating itself?
Yes, of course.
Littered across the concrete are other rusting bits of metal. Some of them are unidentifiable, others clearly recognisable as part of an old aircraft. And the aim, they say, is to put all of these parts together and try and recreate at least one aircraft for the museum so that people can see what a Hurricane looked like all those years ago, flying above the skies of Kyiv and elsewhere.
James Landale reporting. And still to come.
It's quite an incredible experience here. Mukka is really filling out now. We're expecting anywhere between actually 2.5 million to 3 million pilgrims. It could be a record-breaking number.
Huge numbers of pilgrims gather at Islam's holiest site for the beginning of the annual Hajj.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince.
Welcome to the 27th season of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
And we are dealing with some very, very explosive things, such as
bees.
We're going to explain how bees explode, why wasps don't explode, how delicious wasp honey is, before we then climb into a supervolcano, metaphorically.
And then we're going to discover how you might feed yourself inside the supervolcano by eating fungi.
Or ultra-processed food. We're also going to look at ancient DNA and
sharks.
Listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage wherever you get your podcasts.
Who is the all-time best defender in African football? See if your pick made the list on Match of the Day, Africa Top 10.
One of the best. Well, what a player.
Coming soon.
Greece has held its second general election in just 5 weeks. Kyriakos Mitsotakis claimed victory after exit polls showed his right-wing New Democracy Party had secured a clear majority with over 40% of the vote. Mr. Mitsotakis said he now had a strong mandate to quickly introduce major reforms in Greece.
I am thankful and grateful to Greeks for their trust. This generous support increases our responsibility to act on their hopes. Today, we will enjoy our victory, but for tomorrow morning, we will once again roll up our sleeves and begin together to build a strong Greece, a nation with more prosperity and justice for everyone. Tomorrow dawns an even better day for all.
Daphne Tollis is a freelance journalist. Speaking from a busy street in Athens, she told me that the strategy of holding out for an outright majority seemed to have paid off.
The previous election, which was held in May, it was conducted under a different system, proportional representation, that didn't secure the majority to the New Democracy Party. So this time, under the new electoral system, the winning party will receive between 25 and 50 seats as a bonus. This seems that it has secured the New Democracy Party the majority needed to form a government.
So they've convinced the electorate, they've worked the system. What do they want to do?
Well, the Prime Minister, he came and he said that the whole electoral map is blue again, blue meaning that his party, his colour is represented in the country's electoral map as blue, because he has pledged stability and it seems that people voted for stability. He had pledged for investments. He had said that he would boost Greece's tourism industry, which is vital for its economy. So it seems that this stability was what most Greeks went for. They voted for the stability they've seen over the past 4 years compared to all the other years before that when we had the financial crisis.
And apart from financial stability, were there other things on the ballot paper? Can we expect to see anything else change?
Well, we have quite a surprise here with two new parties, which are far right, entering the parliament this time. We already had one small party in the previous elections, but now all three of these far right parties will probably gain many seats in parliament, actually. One of them is the successors of the neo-Nazi party, Golden Dawn, which is called Spartans. So this party, together with another Greek solution, is an ultra-nationalist party. And the new Nikki party or Nike party, these are far-right parties. And all three of them will have secured around 30% of the popular vote.
Which is, I guess, is significant in one way, although if the New Democrats have a clear majority, those smaller parties won't be able to do much.
But they will have seats in parliament. And as we have seen all across other European countries, some extreme-right parties are gaining power more and more, which says something about our times.
Daphne Tollis with me from Greece. There have been heavy clashes in the south of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, as the army and paramilitary rapid support forces fight for control. There's more international concern, too, about ethnically motivated attacks in Darfur. Here's Will Ross.
The Rapid Support Forces have posted videos of fighters celebrating inside what appears to be the headquarters of a heavily armed police unit. They say it's been captured after hours of fighting with the Sudanese army. In the video, you can see many four-wheel drive vehicles which are now in the hands of the RSF. For 10 weeks, the two sides have fought for control of Khartoum, destroying the city in the process and causing misery for millions of civilians. The same RSF paramilitary force has teamed up with Arab militias in the Darfur region. There, they've targeted non-Arab communities in waves of ethnically motivated attacks that have forced tens of thousands of people to flee into Chad.
In Sweden, one person has died and 9 others have been injured after a roller coaster reportedly derailed at a theme park in Stockholm. Police say children are among those being treated in hospital. More from our Europe regional editor, Orlando Thiel.
The 140-year-old theme park was teeming with families on a sunny Sunday morning, shortly before midday, when the accident happened. Eyewitnesses say a carriage from the Jetline roller coaster, which is 30 metres high and travels up to 90 kilometres an hour, broke away from the tracks. This man described what he saw.
At first I heard only a bang, then I turned around. I saw the roller coaster and bang, it backs up. At first I thought it was meant to be that way, but then I saw 2 guys flying out of the carriage. One guy kind of grabbed a pole and just hung there. His face was bleeding. The other guy flew down. He just flew down. That's what I saw.
Ambulances, fire trucks and a rescue helicopter were seen arriving at the park, which was evacuated and has been closed for at least a week. Police say 9 people are being treated in hospital, including several children, and an investigation is underway. A spokeswoman for Gruner Lund said 14 people were on the roller coaster when the front part partially derailed. She promised everything would be done to get to the bottom of what had happened and said their thoughts went out to all those affected.
The Duchess of York has revealed she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. The Duchess, who was formerly married to Prince Andrew, has undergone surgery in London. Here's Greg McKenzie.
The Duchess, who is 63, discovered she had an early form of the disease during a routine mammogram. She reportedly left the King Edward VII Hospital in Marylebone in central London, which has treated the royal family for decades earlier today, and is said to be recovering with her family at Windsor. A spokesman for the Duchess said she was advised she needed to undergo surgery, which has been described as a success. She has been told that her prognosis is good. The spokesman said she was hugely thankful to the staff involved in the mammogram, which identified her illness, which was otherwise symptom-free, and said her experience underlined the importance of regular screening.
A notorious plane used during Argentina's dictatorship to dump political activists in the ocean has made a long-awaited landing in Buenos Aires. The aircraft is expected to go on display in a museum. Here's Rory Gallimore.
The arrival of an empty, ageing cargo plane might not seem like cause for celebration, but to many in Argentina, it's an important symbol, a grisly memory they cannot afford to forget. In the 1970s and 80s, the country's military rulers carried out a gruesome practice known as death flights. Political opponents were abducted, flown out to sea, and hurled into the water. Campaigners have spent years trying to track down the planes. This one was found in the United States, where it was being used to transport skydivers, unaware of its dark past. The aircraft is expected to go on show at Argentina's Museum of Memory to serve as a reminder of the horrors of the dictatorship.
Mabel Correga's mother was one of those thrown from the plane.
For us, it's a matter of history. The plane has to be here in a museum. After having found it and identified it, this country cannot allow the plane from which our loved ones were thrown alive into the sea to continue flying.
Next to Saudi Arabia, where huge numbers of pilgrims have gathered at Mecca, Islam's holiest site, for the beginning of the annual Hajj. It's the first time since COVID there are no restrictions on numbers. It's thought this year could actually see a record attendance. One of those taking part is Yashrab Shah from the charity Muslim Hands.
It's quite an incredible experience here. Mecca is really filling out now. We're expecting anywhere between actually 2.5 million to 3 million pilgrims. It could be a record-breaking number, especially following the COVID restrictions that have been lifted. There were about 900,000 last year. So there's real excitement and real anticipation. Pilgrims will start to move out of the holy city of Mecca. into the valley of Mina. It's extremely hot, between about 42 and 45 degrees. The authorities are trying their best to try to cool the pilgrims, providing lots of fresh water to drink. But we're definitely fearful for some of the older pilgrims that have come from around the world. Everybody's kind of watching each other and making sure everybody is safe and sound. The first time I came for the pilgrimage was back in 2009. You do see a definite improvement in the facilities, the transport, the routes that people are taking. There's a lot of crowd control measures. They've consulted with many governments around the world on how to control large crowds. As you can imagine, it's a huge logistical effort. A city basically springs up of 2.5 million to 3 million people for 5 days and then goes away again.
And the Saudis have big plans for the Hajj going forward, as I heard from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
Saudi Arabia is aiming for far, far higher figures for Hajj over the next decade or so. I mean, they are talking up having millions of people going up to, I think the figure is around 20 million was a figure that they had spoken of as part of this hugely ambitious drive under the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Vision 2030, of which a large part of that is to do with bringing people to Saudi Arabia. Now, obviously, Hajj, aside from work, has always been the main reason that people have gone to Saudi Arabia. What the Saudis are doing is making it easier to go for Hajj, making far fewer hoops that you have to go through. You don't have to go through all sorts of companies and things. And you can get special visas, which allow you also to go and visit other parts of Saudi Arabia while you're there. So I think they're hoping the authorities in Saudi Arabia, there'll be a knock-on effect from Hajj this year and the years that are coming in people going to the other attractions that Saudi Arabia has. So this is partly people, pilgrims who are unable to go. It's one of the five pillars of Islam. If people have the means, they're supposed to go once in their life. So there's that. But even more so, I think it's the Saudis who've been gearing up more and more to try and receive more people and encourage more people to come, and also give them a sense that when they do come, whatever the heat, whatever the numbers, it will be safe.
Sebastian Usher reporting. On Sunday, it was the last night of the UK's biggest music festival, Glastonbury, with a performance by Elton John. It's the first time he's played the event, and it's also been billed as the last UK concert of his career, and so a big moment in music history. He's been performing, after all, for 60 years. And as you can expect, in that time, he's collected many fans.
I love the man. I think he's incredible. My family basically grew up in Elton, so my parents love him. I love him.
We caught up with the BBC's Keith Adams halfway through the concert to ask what the atmosphere was like.
The atmosphere is amazing. I mean, he's between songs right now, but he's playing to an audience of about 100,000 people in front of the Pyramid Stage, which itself is a kind of icon in British music. And the fans have been queuing there, some of them to get the top, you know, the front spot, have been queuing since about 4 in the morning. These are obsessed people who've dressed up as Elton John, which, if some of your listeners don't know, he dresses in an incredibly flamboyant way. Lots of diamante. He's wearing a gold suit tonight. And it's a really lovely atmosphere. There's so much love, I think, that his music is generally very positive anyway. He's started off with these hits in the 70s, like Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, and then he played Pinball Wizard as well so far, Benny and the Jets. So, and then I think he's probably going to move on to some of his more 80s hits shortly. It's a really big sing-along, because if you can imagine, these hits, of which he's had about 50, generations have heard them growing up, and the audience, I dare say, have been preparing as well by listening to his back catalogue. So, I went out into the audience earlier. It's a fantastic atmosphere. Everyone's really enjoying it. And, I mean, I was here last year when Paul McCartney played. Now, he's another icon of popular music, but he is, you know, making new music, and I think in some senses, playing new music to a crowd who want to hear the old hits, it doesn't always go down as well. Elton John doesn't have that problem. He's just hitting them with the old hits, and I must say, they're loving it.
Keith Adams at Glastonbury. And Elton John will end his final world tour, the highest grossing in music history, next month. And that's it from us for now. There will be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you'll find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Audrey.
And I'm Alan.
And between us, we host two podcasts from the BBC World Service.
All about Africa. So, Audrey, tell me about your new podcast, Focus on Africa.
It's every weekday afternoon, and Focus on Africa will explore three essential stories from across the continent, what you need to know about the stories that matter to Africans right now.
And every weekday morning, Africa Daily gives listeners a deep dive into a big question. It's one story from Africa for Africa.
So we'll be focusing on three essential stories to end your working day.
And I'm asking one big question for you to wake up to. Search for Africa Daily.
And Focus on Africa.
Wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
On Valentine's Day 2004, one of Italy's greatest cyclists was found dead in mysterious circumstances.
There's growing mystery about the death of one of the country's sporting heroes, Marco Pantani.
In November 2021, new evidence had come to light, alleging that the Italian mafia were involved in Marco Pantani's death.
The mafia goes where money is.
It's a very dark story, the Pantani story.
Sport's strangest crimes. Marco Pantani, Death of a Pirate.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.